ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do you rely on grandparents to help pay the bills or look after the kids? You're not alone. Life has gotten busier, more expensive, and grandparents are picking up the slack. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the changing role of grandparents in modern family life. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
What Australian novel rattled writer Anna Funder to the bones as a teenager and made her the reader and indeed writer she is today?
I can't remember a time when this book wasn't really part of my psyche. And the same actually goes for Tirralira by the River, because they were books that we studied at school. So I was 15 or 16. And they made such a big impression on me that I really think they sort of changed me at some kind of atomic level. I didn't know then how important those books were in the broader scheme of things. I just knew the impact that they were having on me.
So what is that book, alongside Jessica Anderson's Tirralira by the River, that made such an impact? Find out a bit later as we talk Anna Funder's top three books in the lead up to our Top 100 Australian Books Countdown. Hello and welcome to our weekly mini Readers and Writers Festival here on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans. Cassie McCullough is away for a few more weeks, but luckily there are readers aplenty to guide us through that deluge of new books that come flooding our way each week. Not sure what to read next? Well, we are here to help. And on this episode of The Bookshelf, we're heading to the outrageous nightclubs of 1930s Berlin, right as the world is changing, and into the painful politics of art under Nazism. We move into a high school in Northern Ireland with all its heartache and awkwardness, and spend time backstage and in green rooms in Meg Mason's latest, Sophie Standing There. And to take us into these books, let's meet our reviewers. Stage, screen, adult and children's books. I think we've actually got that all covered. Tom Wright is here, playwright and theatre writer, whose work includes many adaptations of Greek classics as well as of contemporary literature. He's artistic associate at Sydney's Belvoir Street Theatre. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Kate. Always happy to be placed on the shelf. Glad to be back.
Hannah Kent is with us too, novelist, screenwriter and memoirist, whose books include Burial Rites and Always Home, Always Homesick, another regular. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Kate. Lovely to be here.
And Andy Griffiths is here too. He's the Australian Children's Laureate and author of many books for kids, including the Treehouse series, the Just series and his latest, the You and Me series. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Kate, and it's lovely to be here and get a chance to play with the adults instead of the kids. Well, I hope you're adults anyway.
Well, let's just talk about your kids' work just for a little bit more, though. You and Me and the Gigantic Knucklehead is out just this week. That you in this title is you, the reader, and the me is you, the author. So it's all about reading as a collaborative process then, Andy.
Exactly. It was written in response to many children requesting through letters and live talks, could I put them into the next book as a character? And it was such a consistent request. I just thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to have the other character as the reader, which I've always addressed the reader often directly. So it didn't feel like that much of a jump. And then the illustrator, Bill Hope, solved the problem of what the readers look like by putting cardboard boxes over my head and the reader's head, their adventure helmets. And I'm reminding the reader of all these incredible adventures that we've had that they have conveniently forgotten. And I'm helping them relive the adventure.
Well, let's hope we can do the adult equivalent of having the cardboard boxes on our heads and going on a reading adventure. So let's get stuck straight into the books that you've all read for us. And we'll begin with the latest from the Australian, well, let's call her a superstar author, Meg Mason. Writer and journalist Meg Mason was born in New Zealand, but she lives in Sydney, and I reckon we claim her as an Australian writer, don't we? Now, her third book and second novel, Sorrow and Bliss, was the one that hit the big time. It was published in 2020, it won many an award and garnered a huge readership. And it also meant Mason has spent a lot of time at writers' festivals, on stage, backstage, in green rooms, observing things. Now, there's a reason I mention that, and you'll find out why very soon. Her new novel is called Sophie Standing There, and there's a considered comma in that title. It's Sophie, comma, standing there. Her name, that central character, is Sophie Patterson. Why is she standing there? What's she doing, Tom Wright?
Sophie works for a unnamed writers' festival as a sound technician, the person who sets up the mics, sets up the lapels and so on. And anybody who's attended or even been lucky enough to be on stage at a writers' festival will be familiar with those people who are both at the same time utterly present and totally absent, but are necessary glue for such an event. And so Sophie is one of those people, as Milton would say, they serve by also standing and waiting. She's standing in the wings as great writers opine in their comfortable chairs on stage, and as their interlocutors rapidly try to think of their next question. To a certain extent, Sophie, comma, standing there, is also at a stage in her life where she's waiting and standing. She's reached a point where her marriage has come to an end, where she's reaching an age where she thinks, can I possibly live in a rented flat and continue to be on my hands and knees picking up after authors for the rest of my life? She's to a certain extent in a holding pattern. She's standing there.
The awkward thing for both of us, I think, Tom, is that you and I have both hosted many, many events on stage at writers' festivals, and I hope I've never treated producers and sound engineers or stage managers as invisible. Did this make it hard for you to sort of enter the fictional world of this book? It sort of did for me a little bit.
Only momentarily, and I must admit I was somewhat chastened because I did say to myself, did I actually name check all of those people over the many years at Adelaide, Sydney, Melbourne and so on? Did I actually genuinely make eye contact and acknowledge their, you know, contribution? So yes, to a certain extent, I was a little chastened. But I was prepared to accept that the version of the Writers' Festival that Meg Mason puts into her finely written book isn't necessarily meant to be understood as a completely realistic depiction. In some ways, it's in the symbolic order, it represents the place where people who live and love books come together. A Writers' Festival in this case is idea of a place where actually literature and the read life is just as much part of the conversation as the actual life. And in some ways, that's one of the tensions in the book, is that Sophie reads, and she's not just a sound engineer and not just someone who makes sure that authors sound very good. So there's clearly sort of a theme there. But she's also a reader as well. She's read everything that all of these authors have ever written. And as a result, she lives as much in the world of books, of literature, of mediated experience, as she does in her own actual somewhat messy life. And that sets up a tension there. And then when you come into contact with these figures, these writers, who I should say she name checks, Patchett is named, these famous authors that come to her festival are named and spoken about, they almost have demigod status. They've already been established both in Sophie's world and in ours as something more than just human beings. And maybe there's an exploration there. I don't know what you thought, Kate, of that idea of don't meet your heroes. Sometimes it's best just to leave them as you imagine them. Maybe don't have dinner with them at a Chinese restaurant.
Well, and in a way, I thought that is indeed the central tension of the book. What does it mean to be a reader? And what does it mean to imagine the life of the people who are actually creating these extraordinary worlds that we enter into? What is that contract between the reader and writer? And what does it mean when you're then at somewhere like a festival and you see them performing, and that you sort of want their bodies and their attention, and you want to be recognised? And of course, this is something that both Hannah and Andy have had to grapple with. I mean, I have seen the queues for Andy Griffiths at writers' festivals, and they are like, they last for hours and hours. And then Hannah, because you also write memoir, means that people perhaps feel they've got a stake in your life. So as you're listening to us setting up this book, and we haven't yet told you the sort of central plot points. What is it that you are thinking as writers who are also performers on stage, Andy?
I'm thinking how much I have always loved to triangulate my experience of the book with the person who wrote it, with their narrative persona. And they can be quite complementary or they can be wildly different. It's always fun when they're very different. And I remember a story that Colm Tóibín told where he said, I was going out to dinner with the legendary funny writer, an Irish writer who was the funniest writer. And he said, oh, this will be fun. But apparently the funny writer sat there and cried into his beer all night. And Colm Tóibín has a very lyrical, poetic persona on stage, but I've seen him off stage too, and he's quite different. And he said, I get what happens. You go home and get all funny. I go home and get all sad. And often writing is a conduit for those parts of ourselves that we have repressed or don't want to show in public. And it's always fascinating to me to see how an author navigates that with their audience.
And Hannah, part of what this novel, Sophie Standing There, is doing is exploring that all of those boundaries and what happens when they're overstepped or when people presume that they really know a writer because they've both read their books and seen them on stage. And I'm curious about if this is something that you feel you have to negotiate as a novelist.
I think it can be. I do think that it's perhaps a slightly more present or acute situation with memoir. I mean, it's funny, you know, when I was a reader, I would never go get my book signed. I was terrified of meeting the writers I liked because I think I was even then aware that how I understood them was on the page. You know, it was them at their best and most polished and edited. And I was afraid that were I to meet them and experience them as a fellow human, there would be some kind of way that their prose would be diminished in my mind. I don't think I really articulated it as such back then, but I was always very, very wary of meeting people, who, especially those I admired. But since having, you know, being on the other side of the fence, so to speak, what I have noticed is since my memoir came out, you know, people have spent a lot of time with my life. They know quite intimate details, especially I've noticed too, if they perhaps listen to an audiobook, I narrated the audiobook for my memoir, they've had me in their ears for hours talking to them. And it's not that they misunderstand the nature of our relationship or that they presume to know the full me, but I think there's not very much small talk. Let me put it there. I feel like there's also sometimes a transactional kind of storytelling which can take place. You know, they've heard my stories, so they want to give me one of theirs. And I've found that sort of the emotional intensity of those meetings has deepened, both in beautiful ways for which I'm very, very grateful, and also in ways that have surprised me and sort of, you know, take a kind of an emotional energy that I didn't necessarily realise would have to be pulled from me and from them too, you know, as readers.
Well, Tom Wright, let's talk about how that plays out in this novel by Meg Mason, Sophie Standing There, because as you say, Sophie is a reader and she is a very broad and very good reader. And there is an author from some unnamed place, and because we could be anywhere in the Western world in this novel as people come in and out of this.
I think if you imagine Auckland, you're on the right track, but it could be anywhere.
And I even wondered if it was London at one point just because it was going to snow outside, but we could be anywhere. And there is an author whose work she loves. She's read everything she's written. She now has an ARC, an advanced reading copy of her new book. She's listened to the podcast. She's very invested in this writer's work. And then something happens. Elizabeth Strout gets COVID in this fictional world. Elizabeth Strout has to drop out. And so this woman is now coming to the Writers Festival. What does it mean for this character that she's going to have this interaction?
Well, what had previously been the realm of fantasy and the realm of projection and the realm of Sophie being caught in midlife, so to speak, halfway, as Eliot would say, she now suddenly has to realise that she'll meet in flesh and blood this author. And in the early part, she's just referred to by Meg Mason as the author, but then we get her named. The name of this famous writer is Lilac Dunn, and Lilac is hard, but hard in a wise way. as at least in Sophie's imagining, but then we're led as the reader to speculate, what will Lilac be like when inevitably they do meet? And of course they meet under semi-comic circumstances in one of those writers' festival sessions that doesn't quite go according to plan, you might say. But nonetheless, Lilac and Sophie do come face to face. They do come eye to eye and in slightly awkward ways do form one of those slightly odd relationships that Hannah was just referring to, because Lilac is absolutely emblematic of this in terms of Sophie's understanding of her. Sophie knows everything that she possibly could about Lilac and yet knows nothing. Lilac knows nothing of Sophie. She's never met her before and yet seems to know everything. And this is one of the quandaries for me of this book, is that the way Meg Mason has constructed Lilac Dunn, when we do come to meet this famous author, is that she's not so much a human being as an aphorism machine. Everything she says is like a witty bon mot or a very wise observation, and you never really get the sense that there's actually a living, breathing human being at work. And I began to think, this is must be what it's like to come up against the next generation of AI. This is almost, you know, literary genius, but without the beating heart of a human being. And the absurdity of Sophie having not just become obsessed by Lilac, but frankly having eroticized her and fallen in love with her in every sense of the term, suddenly starts to feel destabilizing. And you realize that Sophie, yes, for her, books have become a fantasy world as much as a world of true negotiation.
And isn't it interesting the way that this figure becomes a character made of sentences, made of pages.
Oh, frustrating for me, Kate.
Well, I then started to fantasise about who she was, you know, that she was a mix between Elizabeth Gilbert, yes, Anne Patchett, Deborah Levy, and a spiky Irish writer or two. And then to decide whether, try to work out whether she was wise and acute or frankly awful.
Or if she was manipulating Sophie, because Sophie, of course, being one of those readers that, again, Hannah was referring to, overshares and goes, just cuts through the small talk and goes straight to telling the story of her childhood, her life, the particular religious community that she grew up in. And the author beadily starts saying, oh, tell me a bit more about that. Tell me a bit about this, about your brother-in-law. And suddenly Sophie begins to realise or suspect that she's being mined for material for the next novel, as opposed to being flattered, it's deeply destabilizing. And so this relationship you were referring to earlier, Kate, between reader and writer, but between the read and the written, it starts to come out, which is my material my own, or am I flattered by the idea that the object of my desire is going to incorporate me into their practice, or actually am I deeply appalled by it? And that's kind of where the book, to a certain extent, gets out of first gear and into second.
And our reading position keeps on shifting as to whether we're thinking as a writer or a reader, whose sympathy we're playing with, whose frustration. I mean, because I started to like the way that it was also a book about work, and that part of the thing about Sophie was realising that she was good at what she did. And I liked seeing that
skill. And she's a good human being too, which is a very hard character to write sometimes. And in fact, Meg's put a lot of work into making us understand that Sophie's one of those people who goes the extra mile for everybody at work, in her life and so on, and rarely for herself. And she is also assiduously good at her job. And those things are actually quite hard to capture without making someone feel almost revolting. And yet you never feel that this protagonist is in any way a cliche. It could very easily lapse into sort of a sad girl book, you know, a kind of interiority. I never feel like this novel goes there. And a bit like Sorrow and Bliss, you are very much in the hands of someone who knows how to write. This is a finely written book. And from page one to page 200 and whatever, I never felt like, oh, that's a bit of a jag. Oh, I got my cardi snagged on that bit. No, this is a fine turner of sentences.
Yes, she does know how to write. What I made of the relationship between the reader and writer, I'm still trying to work out exactly what I think about this one. And that's Meg Mason's Sophie Standing There, published by Fourth Estate.
He
here on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, your weekly broadcast and podcast of new fiction. I'm Kate Evans with guests theatre writer and adapter Tom Wright, children's book author Andy Griffiths, and novelist and memoirist Hannah Kent. And why don't we stick with creative lives, but put them under a different sort of threat in Rebecca Birrell's novel, Venus Vanishing, another novel with a comma in the title. It's Venus, comma, Vanishing. Now, Birrell is an English curator and art historian whose first book, a work of non-fiction, was This Dark Country, Women Artists, Still Life and Intimacy in the Early 20th Century. And I think you can tell, even just from that title, that she has a deep knowledge of both art and everyday intimacy. And the story opens with a teenager in Berlin in 1927 who works as a seamstress. She mends things. She understands both clothing and repair and the way cloth wraps around bodies. Hannah, tell us more about this girl and the world she lives in.
Hannah Sherman, when we first meet her, she is telling us about, she's basically on the precipice of change in her life. She has been raised in a family who all work as tailors, seamstresses. Her mother is a seamstress, and she also launders clothes too. But we understand her first not really in terms of the labour that is required of her and has been as she's grown up, but we learn about her through the, I guess, the very specific way that she takes on this particular kind of labour. She's very conscious of bodies. She's very conscious of beauties. She's very conscious of the ways in which clothes have been made and how they may be altered. And she's also very conscious of how intimate it can be when you are a seamstress and you are taking in measurements. She talks of the women who come in, of the way that she knows the smell of their clothes, of the rather strange thing it can be to see those clothes on a person through the street. So we already know from the outset that this is someone who has a creative mindset. This is someone who considers practice, this is someone who acknowledges that things are made and the way in which they might be changed, which I think is actually very, very important, especially as the book progresses. Hannah is also someone for whom art is important. She desires to draw and paint. She wants to be an artist, but her mother, aware of this by the postcards of famous artists she sticks up in her bedroom, wants to shut this down very quickly. Those postcards disappear, and Hannah says that about the time my age and appearance began the summer after I turned 18, mother would point at men in the street and name them as you might different species of birds. He made 48 pfennigs an hour. He owned a shoe store. She's aware that she's about to be married off, and it's really at the prospect of this that she decides to sort of make a final dazzling leap for her true ambitions, which is to be an artist. She leaves home. She runs away. And that's really where this story starts to pick up pace, and we get to know Hannah, not necessarily just as a seamstress, but it's really the story of her developing as an artist and the various people and events that will go on to shape the artist that she becomes.
I love the way that we entered her life because it's about work. These are working class Jewish lives in Berlin. As you say, there's that detail, that intimate detail of bodies and cloth and clothes come up again throughout the entire novel. Postcards and writing notes to each other punctuates the novel, as does this character Hannah's way of looking at the world as an artist. But of course, we know, don't we, that this is a changing world. And that's the balance that a novel like this has to get right, is moving through history without too much sort of foreknowledge of what's coming next. So we know about the end of Weimar, but she doesn't. She can't, can she? So how do you reckon she managed that sort of huge political change that's going on for people like her in Berlin?
I'm so curious whenever I pick up a book and I see the dates and the places that it's set. And in the case of this one, as soon as I looked at the back of it, I was like, oh, okay, we know what's coming. And as a writer, I think you're sort of faced with a couple of options, really. There are some writers, I think perhaps writers who are slightly more lazy or perhaps less considered than Birrell, who will use those external events that they assume everyone is familiar with to sort of give their narrative the kind of shape or climax and rising tension that every book requires. Then there's also people who sort of exploit their characters either by making them overly optimistic or sort of strangely prophetic about what is to come. And that never really rings true for me either. But what I think Birrell has done beautifully is center us so intimately with Hannah and also really ensures that the focus, as it is for Hannah, is on art. So when we hear of things changing or there's little sort of, you know, we realize that the politics at large in the world and in the city outside are, you know, on their way to the events that we're incredibly familiar with, we only really understand it in terms of Hannah's day-to-day life. They are on the periphery. There's several ways too that Birrell sets up the characters in such a way that we will appreciate how difficult the future is likely to be for them. And it really centers us not only on their side, which is going to happen anyway, but it really makes us cheer for art and it really makes us cheer for freedom. And we realize how precious these things are, not only to the characters, but to society and to the world. So, for example, there are two other characters that Hannah takes on as lovers. The first is a young man who works at an art gallery. His name is Saul. He is also Jewish. He is also bisexual, as is Hannah. She soon takes on another lover, Charlotte, who works as a dancer in a lesbian club. And through sort of exploring the sexual fluidity shared by all of these characters, we realize how much their sexuality informs their own artistic practices, but also how much this will later then go on to sort of put them at risk, and how much curtailing their desires and their freedoms will also impact their artistic practice. And I think these are really beautiful, subtle ways of looking at how individual lives were affected by the rise of the Third Reich, but also how so much, you know, art, you know, they couldn't be separated from their artistic practice either, and what that art stands for and what it represents and what it offers up to others too. So I think, yeah, she's clearly thought very, very deeply about this book. I was actually astonished that it was a debut because there is so much research here. And there is so much, you know, reflection you can see on the author's part in terms of how is she going to present these characters, you know, within such a familiar and well-known setting and timeline.
And also the question of how she is going to take a young woman who's got pinpricks on her fingers and whose skin is affected by having to do laundry and to keep working and have her skin cracked by the detergent that she's using, and how she's going to introduce her into the world of art. And so she's going to these queer nightclubs. She's drawing the other women, the dancers there, and she says, because she approaches them and says, can I draw a picture of you? And she says, I wanted women with a dark, severe energy, but they were rare. Most were wild in a temporary way, just as I was. But she does have contact with this other older woman who becomes an art patron. And this is a complicated part of the story, which we can't go into all of it, can we, Hannah? But our Hannah, the fictional Hannah, comes to make artworks for this woman, Elka, and that's where you see art and politics crashing up against each other. What can we say about that?
When we are first introduced to her, to this woman, she is one of the customers who comes to, you know, to Hannah to have a single skirt, I think it is, taken in and laundered. It is only this one single item of clothing. And I think Hannah, when she first describes Elka, says that she's so pale as to be almost colourless. And I mean, she's very tall, she's very thin, she's very glamorous, but she's also cold and remote and distant. But in a book about art, when someone is described as colourless, you know, you sit up and take note as a reader. And really, Elke is someone that we never really are able to understand. We only ever see her through Hannah's eyes. And Hannah herself is a little bit unsure why Elke, when they have reunited after Hannah has left her family and she's started this artistic practice, she really wants to learn. She's also working still as a seamstress. We never really understand why she takes such an interest in Hannah's artwork. Very soon after Hannah has her first exhibition of a painting, Elke makes a proposal. And I don't think it is really too giving away too much to say that she wishes to become Hannah's patron. She wishes to offer her financial support, but there are certain stipulations that come with this. There are particular kinds of paintings that she wishes Hannah to produce. Moreover, she wishes Hannah to paint her in a particular style. And this is where it starts to get complicated. And again, this is where Birrell too does have very clever sort of consideration of what is art and also perhaps what might be propaganda. There's also a huge amount of art in it. And I was always just running away to the computer to look up paintings and artists so I could sort of get the full meaning of why they were so significant in these particular sections of dialogue. I don't think necessarily that you need to have a knowledge of art, but it was something that did kind of sometimes separate me from the narrative. But by the end, I was absolutely hooked. And it wasn't necessarily because, you know, everything is coming to a head. There is incredible violence. There's incredible despair. And you want these characters to make it. You know, this is why you're following it through. It's also because there are, I think, ongoing revelations about the nature of Hannah's artwork, about her own strange connection to Elke. Even when there's certain things come to light, there's certainly an obsession there. So I really thought it gets a little bit messier towards the end, but it was good. I liked that. I thought that made it all the more interesting. But yeah, by the end, I was absolutely emotionally committed to these characters, particularly Hannah and particularly Saul too, who was one of my favourites.
And there is a very good afterwards and, you know, explanation of the research that she's done at the end of this book. And I think that also addresses the question of what fiction can add to historical research and analysis and the leaps that it makes. And so the book we've been talking about is Rebecca Birrell's Venus Vanishing, which is published by Picador. On Radio National's The Bookshelf, with me, Kate Evans, with guests Hannah Kent, Tom Wright and Andy Griffiths, we've travelled to writers' festivals and to underground Berlin nightclubs, to the present and to the past, and so now we'll turn to Northern Ireland and Colin Morgan's debut novel, The Ballad of Ronan McCoy. And if the name Colin Morgan rings a bell with you, it might be because he's better known as an actor of both stage and screen. He played Merlin in the TV series of the same name, for one. Merlin, tutor to King Arthur, in the TV version, still a teenager. And this novel that he's written, The Ballad of Ronan McCoy, begins with an awkward teenage boy and his secret weekend job. So, Andy Griffiths, how do we meet this boy, Brendan? What's he doing and what does it reveal about him?
Brendan is very awkward. He's a loner and he has a passion for washing cars. He's particularly good at it and his talents come to the attentions of the local funeral home run by Mr. Feeney, and he spends his weekends washing all of the cars and the hearse that they use in the business, and this gives him great comfort and joy but also isolates him further from his cohort at school because he doesn't want anyone to know that he's got this weird job so close to the to death, and you know he worries they might think he's a weirdo. He has one friend, like the best friend in the world, who is Ronan McCoy, and Ronan is a polar opposite. He's the best sportsman of the school. He's very popular, has lots of friends, but these two have a particular bond. This is where we meet Brendan on the first day of the final year of school.
I do actually like fiction that takes on friendship and that takes friendship seriously as a relationship. What did you make of that friendship? How well realised was it for you?
Look, this is where I do have reservations. We are told a lot about how wonderful their time together is, how hilarious the jokes are, but I didn't feel a lot of it, and I needed more sort of tangible evidence of why these two had such a great relationship. And I found my mind wandering in unhelpful ways about, well, what is it that's holding them together? Yeah, they love being together at school, but they never see each other outside of school or at weekends, and Ronan goes away for the entire school holidays. So it's a school-based relationship, But yeah, I needed a little bit more about what is it that they have together.
Yeah, we sort of needed to spend more time with them as a group of friends, because we get that terrible awkwardness of this kid, Brendan, who's, there are things going on in his family, his grandmother has died, his mum's depressed. We sort of understand his world, but not the friendship in great detail. We aren't giving things away because this happens fairly early on. Something terrible happens to the friendship. Something happens to Ronan. There's an accident. He has a catastrophic brain injury. So he is no longer the boy that Brendan thought that he knew. I don't know, is that the heart of the novel, trying to make sense of this change?
I think so. It's Brendan trying to, how do I act now with my friend in this state? What are my responsibilities towards him? How do I feel? How is he going to feel towards me? And so this takes up most of the novel, is to how he's going to spend time with Ronan now. And at first they bring him to school, and that's a terrible mistake because Ronan is highly sensitive to noise and everything around him.
And he's nonverbal now.
Nonverbal. His parents, the McCoys, are incredibly understanding, good-natured, good-humoured parents who organise private tutor, and they decide that Ronan could perhaps come in and do a tutoring session once a week with him. But it turns out, you know, Ronan doesn't want another teacher, he wants a friend. Then it becomes an intriguing puzzle to solve as to what is Ronan feeling about Brendan. Is Brendan in love with Ronan? Is Ronan in love with Brendan? Brendan is a difficult character to get a fix on. He seems quite wise at some times and others quite clueless. And I did get a bit impatient with him and a little impatient feeling like I was being manipulated a bit by the author, by crucial information being withheld from me, which I was dying to find out.
And people communicate so badly in a way that is frustrating. And I think that's part of what you deal with as a teenager, is people not telling you things. But I'm with you on the manipulation thing. I did sob through parts of this novel, and it's that thing when you're weeping and thinking, hang on, I've been manipulated here.
As a theatre artist, I can tell you it's not as hard to do as you might think, you know, that those emotional terrain points negotiated once you know how to do it. But I'm intrigued. We've just been talking in Venus Vanishing about the relationship between characters and the space and time that they're forced to inhabit. To what extent in this one are Brendan and Ronan products of their circumstances? To what extent is this a book about its space and time, like Venus Vanishing, or is it a book that could be set anywhere?
Well, Brendan is isolated. He's not getting support from his parents. As Kate said, his mother is depressed and reclusive as a result of her own mother dying. His father has been through the troubles, and it's told that one of the ways he survived the troubles was not to say too much so that people couldn't draw the wrong conclusion about you. So they have a difficult relationship. His father is hassling him to learn how to drive, which is a continual bugbear of Brendan's and becomes a climactic high point of the novel as well. But he's not getting a lot of support. He has a teacher, Mrs. O'Neill, who he describes as someone like a Roald Dahl character. She was so good, and we all know he means Mrs. Honey. But the characters in general are drawn quite broadly like that. The bad, the bully guy, Kevin, is a real bully. Mrs. O'Neill is a real angel. And, yeah, I needed a little bit more grey. I didn't sob as much as I wanted to. I was ready because having looked at the Goodreads early readers and then some of the quotes on the cover, I was ready to need five boxes of tissues. As it turned out, I may have needed half a tissue.
I think he's up against two different things. One is just how much great literature is coming out of Ireland.
Yep.
So sophisticated, so interesting. I mean, and not just experimental stuff, writing that is entirely accessible and beautiful and does all of this. Like, I could list 20 writers who are doing this really well. So that's one thing. The other is who it's pitched for, because I got about three chapters in and thought, actually, is this a young adult novel? I mean, not that there's not good YA fiction, because there is, but it works in a slightly different way. And I wondered if that was also part of it, Andy.
I think you're right. It is a YA novel. I think what he does really well is capture some of those early emotional relationship confusions that you might have around 16, 17. He has an interest from a girl called Jenny, who all but gets him to invite her to the school dance. I love that he's sort of confused about what he's feeling towards her and how he balances that with his feelings towards Ronan. That felt genuine to me. So I liked that aspect of the book.
And that's Colin Morgan's The Ballad of Ronan McCoy, published by HQ. Well, I've loved hearing your collective reading expertise, but I also want to know about your recommendations here on the bookshelf, with an eye to Australian books in particular. Hannah Kent, new books or old, it's your choice. What would you like to recommend?
I actually want to recommend a bunch of books that I discovered when I was going through one of the boxes in my shed, and I found all of these incredible Australian children's books that, you know, had an enormous impact on me when I was young. I was getting them out for my daughter, actually, and amongst them was Storm Boy, which is not a book I've really thought about in a long time, but it made me reflect on Colin Tierley and his legacy, because I also loved Bluefin and Sun on the Stubble. And I think Storm Boy particularly is a book which has really held up over the years and is one that I'm definitely going to push on my kids. So for anyone who is considering a bit of revisit to Tierley, I recommend it. I think I've also been thinking about this a lot too, because, you know, I know what's coming for the ABC as well. And I'm interested in looking back at those books. Another one was Paul Jennings' Uncanny, which was a book that gave me nightmares in the best way as a kid. And that's another one I've added to my pile. And also a beautiful book by Jackie French called Somewhere Around the Corner, which I think, you know, is this incredible book about a girl who literally turns around a corner and finds herself back in time. And if I had to pick perhaps a book that made me start thinking about historical fiction as a kid, it was that one. So there you go. There's three classic Australian books for children.
Well, I love a time slip novel as well, but I haven't read that one. Well, why don't we stay with the whole children's book expertise? Andy Griffiths, what Australian book would you recommend to us and why?
Well, I've been inspired by the Radio National quest to find the best Australian book to go back to Seven Little Australians, which I thought I knew because I'd watched an old, decades-old television show of it, and I was quite affected by that. But the book is just wonderful. I love how it starts. You know, all Australian children are all naughty, and it's wonderful, light writing. But then it really delves into the psychology of both the children and the adults. And I found it very modern and hard to believe that it was written, I think, in the late 1800s.
Or yeah, 1890s.
Yeah. It felt so modern to me. I thought, oh, she must be writing in the 1950s or with the benefit of a lot of psychological understanding. So that was a real thrill. My brother Jack, I have always intended to read again for many decades, and that is equally awe-inspiring. I just absolutely love it.
George Johnson.
I've got my pencil out and I'm writing down something on every single page that I want to remember. So George Johnson, my brother Jack, and of course from a children's point of view, it's hard to go past The Magic Pudding as a prototype children's book. I can see he's been influenced by Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and I think I have subconsciously taken a lot from this book to create the Treehouse series, even down to the layout of generous pictures, generous white space, and just a certain amount of type on each page, and a free-flowing plot that is, you know, Monty Python would be proud of some of the nonsense in this.
Come again, Puddin'.
Yeah. I don't know if this is going to work for modern audiences. I think I've probably taken the spirit of it rather than the letter, but, yeah, every time I go back, I admire it all over again.
Well, that is a great collection, which, as always, we do list on the in the show notes for the bookshelf. Tom Wright, last time you were here, you reminded us of Sumner Locke Elliott's Careful He Might Hear You, another book with a comma, from 1963. What would you like to offer up this time?
I've somewhat obscurely been reading the collected short stories of the wonderful Melbourne writer of the 30s and 40s, Pinchas Goldhar, G-O-L-D-H-A-R. Pinchas Goldhar is interesting in the history of Australian writing because he wrote in Yiddish. His short stories are exquisite little gems written in Yiddish of observation of life in inner city Carlton. So those readers who are familiar with Judah Watton's Alien Sun or the work of Arnold Zabel will know this world, this milieu, this particular element of the Australian migrant experience. But Goldhar's the real thing. This is the story of people not dissimilar in some ways to a book we've been discussing today, caught between knowing about the past and not knowing what's to come, but sensing deeply from the other side of the world the terrors and traumas that their people are going through. I love Pinchas Goldhar. He died young. He only died in his 40s, alas. His novels and his writings, I should say, only come out through translation decades after his death, but they are neglected gems. This is fine, fine social realist capturing of families, of individuals, beautifully described weddings, moments in the street, what it's like to be a working class Jewish man surrounded by Australian anti-Semitism in the 1930s and 40s. An exquisite little book and maybe a footnote to literature, but who knows, maybe for some might open up entire new vistas. So that's the collected short stories of Pinchas Goldhar.
How wonderful. And that is exactly what we want this Top 100 Australian Books project to do, is to both remind people of the books that are already on their shelves and to search out those that they have never heard of and that they absolutely must read. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us on the bookshelf.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kane.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Hannah. And thank you, Kate, for steering the ship solo.
Yes. Well done.
Well done.
Thank you so much. Regular reviewers there, theatre writer Tom Wright from the Belvoir Street Theatre and novelist and memoirist Hannah Kent. Also with us, Australia's Children's Laureate Andy Griffiths, who's throwing himself into events and appearances around the country right now because You and Me and the Gigantic Knucklehead has been released just this week. Earlier on the bookshelf, I promised to reveal the books that shaped Anna Funder as both a reader and a writer. So how about she introduces them for us?
Why don't we start with Christina Stead, who comes first in time, I guess, and The Man Who Loved Children. I can't remember a time when this book wasn't really part of my psyche. The same actually goes for Tira Lira by the River, because they were books that we studied at school, so I was 15 or 16. They made such a big impression on me that I really think they sort of changed me at some kind of atomic level. I didn't know then how important those books were in the broader scheme of things. I just knew the impact that they were having on me. Both of them have female protagonists, so The Man Who Loved Children is Stead's masterpiece. I think she published maybe 15 novels in her life, but this is, I think, widely acknowledged as the most important and the most profound, and it's the most famous. It's based on her family of origin as she grew up in Sydney. She was born in 1902 in Sydney, but she had to transpose it to set it in the US because her US publisher said no Americans are going to read a book set in Australia. And it's the story of the Pollitt family. Louisa is the main character. She's 11 and a half at the beginning of the book. Her mother died when she was two. Her father remarried a woman called Henny. Her father's name is Sam. And they live in kind of flamboyant, operatic, marital disharmony, where they either scream at each other or only communicate via one of their other seven children who they had after they got married. So Louis is the eldest and she tells all her siblings stories and she keeps them going. I mean, I didn't have the language for it when I was a teenager and was reading it. It is a book about what it is to be an ugly duckling, what it is to want to be a writer and not know whether you will be able to, full stop, or whether you will be able to escape your monstrous Punch and Judy background. And it's just the most phenomenal book. I think it's probably one of the best novels, full stop. Certainly one of the best Australian novels, full stop. When Randall Jarrell was writing an introduction to the 1965 edition in the States, so very famous poet and critic, he had to come to terms with the fact that the book was published in 1940, 25 years before, and hadn't been recognised. There's probably lots of complicated reasons for that. So it was a masterpiece published in 1940 and then had slipped between two stalls of Australia and the States, had, I think I'm correct in saying, a kind of nasty, unwarranted review from Mary McCarthy, a lesser writer, and was a bit lost. And then Jarrell comes along and really says, we need to compare this book to Tolstoy's War and Peace, to Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, to Proust's A la Recherche. This is one of the great masterpieces, and I think it is.
Can you remember why it made such an impact on you, though, when you read it as a teenager? I mean, how did you read it as a teenager?
I remember a lot of things about it. As I say, I'm kind of partly weirdly constituted by this book. I remember mostly the fact that Louis is sort of 12. She's blonde. She finds herself disgusting. Her stepmother calls her, you great fat slob, all the time. She's gawky. Really, there's a lot of self-hatred combined with a lot of ugly duckling ambition that may or may not come to anything. And I think I just totally identified with that. I didn't have, my mother wasn't calling me those names, but I certainly thought about myself in that way. And I think that was very profound as a kind of uncoordinated, gawky, pale, slobby early teen. And I think the other thing that was so profound to me was the first time I read it for school, I thought Henny is the mother who is this histrionic, fainting, complaining, vicious, trapped woman who came from a wealthy family, and she marries Sam, who is a naturalist, an egomaniac, a fantasist, massively intrusive on his children's lives, but he thinks about himself as the great savior of humankind and animal kind, and he has a veneer of kind of, I am the great United Nations, I am a teetotaling crusader for human rights, all of this hypocrisy, and actually he's awful. But the first time I read it, I thought Henny was this vile creature who was so vicious. And then the second time I read it, you get this, it's like life. The novel is so big, it's like life, because you see it one way and then you completely change. And I completely changed to seeing Henny as this woman trapped by a really monstrous man and his equally monstrous ego.
Given that it was transplanted from Sydney to America, does it still have a particular Australian flavour?
Yes, definitely. So when you know that she grew up in near Arncliffe and then Watson's Bay, and there are a lot of scenes that are sort of, I think of as being in Watson's Bay, and she's transposed, because they're sort of tidal water flows, lots of nature, and she's transposed them to the US. I think if you're American and you know a lot about nature, it might not quite work. For me, it was totally fine. The thing that is most profoundly Australian about this, I think, is the pitiless vision that Stead brings to her characters. She is not after moments of redemption, although they come, but she's not after that. She's not after any kind of sentimentality. She's after this absolutely clear, almost like the daughter of a scientist, the daughter of, and I am one too, the daughter of a naturalist looking at things to find their absolute truth and essence in every detail. So the review, when it came out in 1940 in The New Yorker, said this book is like as if it's Little Women written by a demon. And I just think to myself, that is so telling about America and Americans and what they want from literature. And I sometimes find this now in a kind of, I'm not talking about Little Women in particular, but what I would think of in a very hard-headed, hard-hearted way as a pat straining to see the good in people. I'm not sure for me that that is, I mean, of course I've done it and I'm interested in that, but I'm not sure it is a main motivation in life or in art, and I think it wasn't for Stead. And so her vision of this horrific, operatic, unhappy, yet loving, yet kind of functioning, yet not functioning family from which she comes is not dusted over with the icing sugar that that reviewer may have wanted. So calling her a demon is says a lot more about what an American vision is, and also by extension about the courage of a particularly, I think, Australian vision to name things and see things and not be looking always for redemption, not be looking always for the good in people. I think that that is a blinkering of artistic vision.
Yes, almost sounds like Puritanism meets sentimentality.
So my next choice is Jessica Anderson's Tirralira by the River, which was published in 1978. And it was written in the 70s. And I read that at the same time as I read The Stead. These were books that were all on the course for HSC students in the early 80s, along with actually Carson McCullers, The Member of the Wedding. So they were this brilliant trifecta of powerful books about what it is to be a young woman or a young misfit or a young artist in the case of the Anderson. So this book won the Miles Franklin. It is a small book, but it is like something from another planet that is denser than material that we have here on Earth. I mean, it's, I don't know, 130 pages, but it is this whole world of a woman who grows up in Brisbane Anderson was born in 1916. Her character, Nora, is born earlier, about the same time as Stead in 1902. Nora grows up in Brisbane, and the book is essentially about what it is to be an artist in your marrow, to have a need to create something which reflects your vision of the world, which gives form and meaning to the world. And in Anderson's case, it's obviously in literature. In Nora's case, it's in tapestries. To be that, but to be born at a time and in a gender and in a place which makes it almost impossible for you to recognize that that's what you are. So the struggle of Nora she has to leave Brisbane. She gets married and comes to Sydney and lives actually in Bomera, a beautiful house, which I believe is still there on Potts Point in Sydney, which at that time was filled with a mishmash of different artists. But she enters into this marriage, which takes her away from there and into these horrible brick and cement suburbs of Sydney, where she suffers through a terrible marriage. And her husband calls her frigid when she doesn't enjoy sex, and then when she begins to enjoy it, calls her a whore. So Anderson sets up this incredible financial and physical entrapment of Nora in this marriage, and also this sexual Scylla and Charybdis, if you like, that there was no option for women to find pleasure and full personhood in their sexuality. Then Nora goes to London, where she is much happier and is among people who don't ask her the kneecapping, I don't know if it's an Australian question or not, but it's an absolutely kneecapping and often gendered question, who do you think you are? Who does she think she is? Which is what makes it impossible for her to recognise herself as an artist. The book, it takes place when Nora's an old woman and she's coming back to Brisbane, and she takes us through this life looking at what it was to be her, what it was she became, how she did or did not manage to pull out of this life something of an artist to leave. It's a magnificent book.
Anna Funder, what's your third choice?
My third choice is Fiona McFarlane's Highway 13, which I really feel like rereading immediately. It's such a masterpiece. It's a fairly recent book of 12, not really interlinked, but thematically connected stories that vary enormously in their range and form, but they all have fabulous imaginative emotional intensity with their characters. Highway 13 refers to a fictional highway, like a highway going south from Sydney. The book is, it's almost doing it a disservice to say this, but that highway goes through a forest in which a serial murder killed a lot of young backpackers and tourists and travellers. So it's, that character is based on Ivan Milat, who we all know and get a frisson of horror about that. But he, or the character based on him, doesn't really appear in the book. There's nothing gruesome in the book. The stories are much, they're from all different periods. They go back to the 50s and then back in, up into the 90s and beyond. They're all about people who, at one remove, or sometimes a bit closer, or sometimes three removes, have something to do with one of the victims or with him. So it gives you this very profound sense of the enormous reverberations that happen, like a stone being dropped in a pond, the sort of width of them in expansive relationships and in time of such an evil act. That's the sort of structure, but actually each story is immensely pleasurable because she's so skilled at taking you into the minds of very different people very quickly so that you utterly believe that you are in, you know, the local politician's mind at the sausage sizzle who happens to bear the same name as the murderer, or the couple in Newtown who at one point, you know, offer accommodation to a distressed backpacker who's there, who ends up possibly being one of the victims. So it's like a kaleidoscope loosely linked by this one horrible act.
It's so rich and vivid, and then weirdly it's defined by what it doesn't do, which is this wonderful restraint in refusing to look a killer in the eye and instead look at everything around it. I mean, it's just sort of intoxicating, isn't it?
It is absolutely intoxicating. It's magic. I don't know how she does it. It's brilliant. It looks effortless. I'm sure it's not. It's that restraint, as you say, is it's an aesthetic decision, it's a structural decision, but at its base, that's a moral decision. And it's a very comforting place for a reader to be. But I think to not feature the murderer, to not give him that airspace, time, fame, it's a bit like not naming sometimes people who do terrible acts of evil and terror in the media, is I like to sit in that space as a reader where I am not ghoulishly giving evil more attention, but rather in sympathy with this rippling effects of it on other people.
Anna Funder, novelist, essayist, and professor of practice in creative writing at the University of Sydney. Her books include Stasiland, All That I Am, and Wifedom. And in July and August, she's holding a series of talks all around the country entitled Telling Untold Stories, which reflect on the work, research, and thinking behind her books. Her top three Australian books ahead of our top 100 Australian books countdown were Christina Stead's The Man Who Loved Children, Jessica Anderson's Tirralira by the River, and Fiona McFarlane's Highway 13. As always, you can find lists of all the books mentioned, as well as earlier discussions, on the show notes in ABC Listen or via your podcast catcher of choice, or indeed just go to abc.net.au and find the bookshelf page. I'm Kate Evans. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.